Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is former Third Court of Appeals Justice Scott Field. Justice Field, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we're glad to have you. You're one of our early guests, and we thought we'd ask you on to talk about a couple of things that you have a unique perspective on. But before we do that, will you give us a little background and kind of introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. As you said, I served on the Third Court of Appeals from 2013 through 2018. Currently a partner at Butler Snow here in Austin. You've known me for a long time because we were co-law clerks for Earl Gonzalez in the Texas Supreme Court, straight out of law school. And after spending a number of years at Baker Botts, went out with a few partners and formed a small boutique firm, and then eventually practiced on my own before going on to the court.
Well, so you mentioned that you were at Butler Snow now. I know you've talked a little bit, given a CLE panel presentation recently about transitioning from being a justice on the Court of Appeals to back to private practice. I think we'd like to cover that with you first. What was the overview? Can you give us like an overview of the perspective that you bring on that?
Sure. Do you mean to the practice itself?
Or just, well, I mean, just covering generally that topic. I mean, I think, you know, unfortunately, we've seen in the last couple of election cycles, some folks involuntarily returned to private practice.
Right.
And I don't think you'd mind me saying that that was your fate. That's Definitely. What brought you back, because you served 6 years on the Third Court and did so, I think, with distinction. And knowing each other the way we do, I know everything about the story. But Jody and our other listeners.
Yeah, I don't.
And so just give us some background on that.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I've talked to people about this, you know, Craig Enick and Del Wainwright, who left the bench voluntarily, and how that differs from those of us who didn't leave by choice. Craig Enick, you know, talked about how it's incredibly excited he was to go back to private practice. And I think when it's not your choice, it's a little less exciting, but at least initially. And it was interesting, after the election happened, a lot of us who lost were on the phone with each other, you know, constantly. You know, we become friends. You become friends through the appellate community, right, beforehand. And then when you're on the bench, you see each other at judicial conferences. So, you know, I was calling people, Brett Busby and Jane Bland and Bill Boyce and, you know, a bunch of people. We were all talking about, okay, who have you interviewed with and what are you thinking about doing? And we'd find firms that had interviewed several of us and things like that. And so, you know, everyone had different perspectives. I had a hard time figuring out what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to a large firm, if I wanted to start my own practice again, if I wanted to go do mediations and arbitrations. The scary part when you're in that situation is, you know, for at least from my own perspective, I had my own firm. I had a pretty solid book of business. Everything was going well. And went on the bench, you give away all your clients, you shut down your firm. And for 6 years, you're on the bench. And I loved it. I would have stayed there for a long time had the electorate allowed it. But the hard thing is coming back and realizing that you're basically starting over. Yes, you've been a judge, but from a business perspective, you're starting over. And that's the, I think, the most challenging part. From a practice perspective, it's been great. I love advocating. I think I like the objective deciding cases better, but I love advocating. But you have to convince people that you add value. And then number two, you have to actually, look, we all know people don't know who the judges are. And that goes for people in the business community too. They don't know who the judges are, but, you know, people vote on this, but they have no idea. So from the business community perspective, what I find is you talk to in-house counsel at different companies, they don't even know that what happened in the election. They don't realize that statewide we lost 400 judges overnight. What was it, 31 or 32 on the appellate courts? They have no idea. And so they don't know who I am, and they don't know what I can bring to the table for the most part. So it really is an interesting, you know, in the legal world, you assume people, okay, well, they probably, you know, they know the Third Court of Appeals. They might have run into me at some point, but in the business world, they have no idea who you are.
So, Scott, for those of us that don't know you very well, what were you doing before you went on the bench? What was your practice like?
So it was kind of a split practice between litigation and appellate. Like Todd, I admire Todd and others who have been able to do 100% appellate, but I did both. I had done that practice from the get-go at Baker Botts. I was in their trial and appellate departments overlap. I don't know if they still do, but back then they did. And so I did both, and I enjoyed both. I'm one of those rare appellate people who actually, I really love going in front of a jury and arguing. I love interacting with people. This whole isolation thing is driving me crazy. So I had a practice that was probably 60-40 weighted toward trial. And then, of course, went on the appellate bench. And then on the other side, what's interesting, the other side of the firm, and really way people think of me now, is 100% appellate. And I find myself, you know, even when I'm supporting a trial or something like that, you know, there's a piece of me inside that's like, here, let me take a witness. which I think is unusual for an appellate lawyer. But I've done a good job of staying in my lane and just doing the appellate side.
Now that you've been on the bench, you've been in private practice, and you're back with a different firm, what are some things that you learned while you were on the bench that you wish you'd known before you went on the bench?
You know, the biggest thing to me is I feel like lawyers, and I'm right there with everyone, we tend to over-lawyer things. You know, people get so worked up over the smallest things in their cases. And you realize after serving on the bench that those things hardly ever, if ever, matter. Things like, let me give you an example. And I think I can do this now that the case is pretty much over. Perfect example of this is I did appellate support of a 4-week trial in Philadelphia right when I got back into practice. And the rules up there, you have to do a full briefing JNOV within 7 days of the verdict.
Wow.
Crazy. we have all these lawyers, huge case, tons of lawyers from all over the country, drafting different pieces of this JNOV, 120-page draft. At 1:30 a.m. the morning it's due, I'm on the phone, and I think it's at least 4 or 5 lawyers, Philadelphia, Chicago, San Francisco, me, and some others. And these lawyers are arguing about a paragraph that's on page 84 of the JNOV. And I just had enough. And I finally said, can I ask all of y'all a question? I said, is there anything in this paragraph that we've been arguing about for 10 or 15 minutes? And I say we loosely because I wasn't arguing about it. Is there anything in this entire motion that the court is going to grant? Is there any chance at all? And the answer was no, this judge hates us. He's not going to grant anything. I said, okay, well, is there any doubt in anyone's mind on the call that we've preserved error as is? This JNOV preserves error as it is right now. Well, no, we've preserved error. Then why in the world are we spending client money and up at 1:30 a.m. arguing about something on page 84? And I can tell you the lawyers on the phone didn't really appreciate the comment. It was kind of interesting. Because I think as lawyers, we so often let the perfect become the enemy of the good. And that's what I've really learned as a judge is, look, the good is what you want. I mean, you got to preserve error. You got to make the argument. The fact that your sentence is perfect is not going to win the day. And that's a change in me since I've been on the bench. I'm much more streamlined in the way I look at cases, the way I look at arguments. And sometimes you know, sometimes that's a great thing. Sometimes clients don't even want to hear it. Sometimes clients really want, you know, they want to sit and argue about page 84 as well. But from my perspective, so much of what we do, it matters, but not to the extent we care about it.
I don't want to deride our trial lawyer brothers and sisters, but it seems to me that what you just described is sort of a skill set that we develop as appellate lawyers. You know, the ability, and appellate judges, I would add, the ability to cut through the fluff and see what's really important. Because I tell folks all the time, it's like, look, you probably have maybe three decent issues in your case.
That's right.
And if you're arguing that fourth, fifth, sixth issue, if you think that's the one that's going to get you relief, you're sadly mistaken. And I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, your perspective on that. That's in my hip pocket for almost every client. It's like, look, you may think that the judge did all these things wrong, but at the end of the day, there's only going to be a handful of things that could get you the relief you want if we persuade the Court of Appeals to go with us on those.
That's
because,
right.
Because, you know, people are still get hung up on evidentiary issues. And I say, look, admitting or excluding evidence is almost never going to lead anywhere. You spin your wheels. And to me, it's really important in this day and age when we've got to be as efficient as we possibly can be in handling an appeal. It really should, as you're suggesting, trickle down to the trial level. And that, I think, is where folks like the three of us really can help. Is, and I'm glad to say that I've got, you know, lawyer clients who know this about me, that, you know, you're going to be able to cut through the fluff, Todd. You're going to be able to see the things that are important. And so that, it sounds like that was kind of the case in that Philadelphia trial, where the lawyers were just, they lost, you know, seeing the forest for the trees, and are arguing about the minutiae that in the end just really doesn't matter.
No, it's so hard to convince some lawyers of that. But what I've found are the really good trial attorneys understand that having an appellate attorney involved in the trial level helps exactly with what you're saying. You know, cutting through the issues that don't really matter, streamlining things. It's kind of like the old adage, the old advice a lot of trial lawyers used to give, doing the jury charge first. You know, no one really does that, unfortunately, because clients usually won't pay for it. But having an appellate lawyer involved at the trial level is exactly that in some ways. It's like having the jury charge done already. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, by the time we get in, sometimes it is. But it's that bringing that view of, well, look, why are you worried about this issue? Because that doesn't answer the question the jury's going to be asked. It's that kind of thinking. And then, of course, honing in on the legal issues, that really helps. And as you know, Todd, I mean, even when I was trying cases, I would always have someone else there worrying about the jury charge. And because my view was, if you're trying the case, you ought to be focused on the witnesses and the jury and judge, and let someone else worry about the legal issues. And then, of course, we've all played the role of appellate attorney as well. And it's a great 1-2 punch, but a lot of lawyers out there don't realize it. A lot of clients don't realize it or aren't willing to pay for it.
You mentioned dealing with the jury charge. What I tell trial lawyers is, you're about to make your closing argument. You need to be focused 100% on your closing argument. This is the point in the trial where you get to, you know, wrap it all up and tie it up with a bow and tell the jury exactly what you want them to do. Do you really want to shift from arguing this minute point of an instruction and a jury charge to 10 minutes later, you know, making your jury argument? And I know it's one of the reasons why I didn't excel at trial work was that I couldn't make that mental shift that quickly. Some people, I think, can, but it's just tough.
It's extremely hard to do that. It really is. It's just a different skill set. And even if you can do it, the question is, should you be doing it?
Now, speaking of arguments, Scott, did being on the bench change your perspective about the value or maybe the strategy that you would use going into oral arguments?
You know, it's really funny. My approach on oral argument is really subconsciously. I don't think I intended it, but according to my partner, Amanda Taylor, I'm much different at oral argument now than before I was on the bench. And I think in a good way. I've felt better about my first, I've only had two since I've been on the bench, but I've felt better about those than I've ever felt about oral arguments before. And some of it's just the approach. It's much more conversational now. And admittedly, I have some leeway with that, having been on the bench, because the judges I'm arguing to have been on the bench. And so that it's kind of an unfair advantage in some ways. But I've found what the 20 minutes now, or however long they end up giving you, if they let you, is really more, okay, let me help you write the opinion in my client's favor. Here's how it's going to look. Mm-hmm. And taking them through basically an outline, and then let me help you fill in the details of what that opinion is going to look like. And it's very different now. I used to go in more with the, ooh, I want to make this point, and I want to make that point. And I still have that. Believe me, it's all ready to go. But I'm far more interested now in figuring out, because I know there's someone up there who's drawn the opinion, and the only reason they've said it is they're having trouble writing the opinion. I mean, really and truly, the only reason judges said oral argument at a court of appeals level is if they're having trouble writing the opinion, or there's some authority issue. And so I'm now trying to figure out where in the outline that I have for how they would write an opinion in my client's favor, where is that hurdle, and how can I help them get past it?
That reminds me, I think it was Randy Roach for years has taught this concept of, you know, how do you help the judges do their job? And that just, to me, that just echoes, you know, what Randy has said. I think, but you're right, you do have a completely different perspective than most advocates going in who want to make their points and be right and get through the questions and move back to their outline.
Well, Amanda just laughed the other day. I had one, and I didn't even think about it until she mentioned it afterwards. She said it was a TCPA case, and they raised this issue. Said, well, how do we deal with X, Y, and Z? And I want to give it away because it's still pending. And my response was, you know, I had that come up in a couple of cases, and here's how I dealt with it. And I didn't do that as a, you know, hey, look at me. It was just natural. I was having a conversation with someone who I knew exactly what they were struggling with. I knew I had struggled with it in a TCPA case before, and here's how I dealt with it.
Yeah.
And it's a license I had because of my experience. But also, I think it's the exact strategy you're talking about. Any appellate lawyer can do that just by saying, yeah, I've seen that issue come up, and here's how I would deal with it, and here's how other courts have dealt with it, and here's how I would deal with that. And I think anyone can do it. It's just a little bit different perspective.
Sure. I'd like to shift gears now. That's a great perspective, and thank you for sharing that. It's significant, I think, for listeners to hear it. I'd like to shift gears now to the second topic that we were interested in exploring with you, and that is, you wrote a couple of articles, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, addressing the mental health issues in the judiciary. As you know, in my term as president of the Austin Bar, I've kind of made that a priority, not judiciary specifically, but lawyer well-being, you know, across the profession and in our local bar. And you were gracious enough to write this article called "Don't Forget Judges Are People Too," which you followed up very shortly after with a Texas Lawyer article titled "The Mental Challenges Judges Face." And we're going to post links to those articles in the show notes for this episode for folks to see. But tell us a little about what led you to write those articles.
Well, so I'm on the well-being committee that you started with the Austin Bar. And as I recall it, we were in a brainstorming session of articles that could be in this well-being series. And I think it was Erica Grigg. I'm not sure. But I think it was Erica Grigg at TLAP. I think everybody probably knows Erica. Her personality is big enough that if you don't know her, you'll be interested in her. I love Erica. But anyway, she said something about, we've always wanted to come up with something to address judges and get them talking about these issues. And I volunteered, and I got to be honest with you, I wasn't quite sure what I would write, but I volunteered to write an article. And as I started writing, or started thinking about it, I knew exactly what I wanted to write about, which was a just kind of a dark time in my life and how judging affected it. And then, of course, the fear and the self-doubt came in of, oh my gosh, do I really want to share this with anyone? Is this just me writing about me? And is it really going to help anyone? If it's not, then why am I doing this? And all the doubt. And I have to tell you, I wrote that article. And it only took me, I bet I wrote that thing in half an hour, 45 minutes, because it was so personal, it was easy to write. That I sat there and looked at the send button for I don't know how long before I sent it to the Austin Bar because it made me nervous. And it went out and I didn't, you know, it was published. I didn't hear anything in a couple of days. Well, all of a sudden people started sharing it on social media. And the next thing I know that, you know, it took off. And suddenly judges were chiming in. And because I had sat as a judge, you know, a lot of these folks are personal friends, and I started getting texts and emails and from judges I knew. And the next thing I know, I started getting handwritten notes from judges all over the country that I didn't know. And I realized that unwittingly on my part, I'd kind of hit a nerve that there's a lot more people struggling with the very issues I identified than I realized. And then, of course, the Texas lawyer contacted me after that to see if I'd write a follow-up, and that's follow-up was about. But I think the first one is the one in the Austin Bar that got the.
You know, it's easy to forget, I think, for people that judges often encounter people on the worst days of their life. You're dealing with family, you're dealing with freedom, you're dealing with finances. And by the time someone's in a courtroom, particularly in an appellate courtroom, something has gone wrong for somebody to get to that point. And I think you just kind of think, well, judges are sort of these automatons. They get on there and make these decisions and you just go home at night. But of course, you're going to take that with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the key. And I think, you know, I've always told when I was on the bench, I always told my trial judge friends that I thought they had it harder because they have to look at the people. They have to see them. They have to see the emotion. And you know, especially if you rule from the bench, how difficult that is. But appellate, what's so hard about appellate too is, you know, in my situation, I detailed in that article, you know, a lot I was going through with my parents' care at that point and just how incredibly depressing that was. Well, then all of a sudden you get into a record, you know, the examples I used, what I did, I had three in a row, you know, I had a gang rape of a 15-year-old that was a long trial. So it was a long record. And then I had a very, very close, which is unusual, by the way, termination of parental rights appeal. And then another criminal one for starvation of an infant, intentional starvation of an infant. And I didn't realize I was that in combination with what was going on in my outside life was bringing me down. And I made some adjustments once I realized it that really helped. And that's why, you know, that's what I suggest in the article, some tips to help judges and to help lawyers help judges. But you're right, Jody. I mean, you know, these judges, they have stuff going on in their life too. And they're making decisions. And a lot of times they don't realize the effect it's having on them. I got a handwritten note from a district judge across the country who said, I've been on the bench for 5 years now, read your article and a light bulb came on. And it made me realize why I've been treating my wife and daughter wrongly. And I'm going to make some changes.
Wow.
And I thought, I couldn't believe it. And the honesty was amazing to me. And I thought, okay, you know what? People need to start talking about these issues more.
Absolutely.
It's helping people.
What are the tips? Do you have a few that you could just kind of offer? We'll certainly post in the show notes, but.
Yeah. I mean, for judges, and they're pretty, and they're mostly simple and common sense, but for judges, now, look, it's difficult because every judge has a different docket, right? Mine, on the Austin Court of Appeals, we were actually close to 70% civil, 30% criminal. So what I realized I needed to do is if I had a really nasty criminal case or termination case or some other just depressing content, I need to mix in your regular civil case on the next one. Because as an appellate judge, you can choose, right? You can choose what you work on next. Well, mix in yours or Todd's cases after after the particularly depressing criminal case, or even a tax case or an administrative case. Just very, don't sit and read records for 3 weeks on horribly depressing. But also, you know, even for the judge, you can't get away from it. You know, let's say it's a district judge on the criminal side. That's very hard to get away from it. Make sure you're actually staying in contact with the outside world. I think the toughest thing for judges is isolation. It's very weird in Texas. You know, you go through an election, you're on the road constantly, you're constantly shaking hands and meeting new people. And I mean, whether we like it or not, you become a politician for a short time. And then you win, you have your investiture. That's a big to do and kind of party. And then you go to your chambers and everything goes quiet. Everything is quiet. And the phone doesn't ring, which, by the way, for a practitioner sounds awesome. But for, you know, after about a year of it, you realize the phone doesn't ring. You might get 10 emails a day, which again, sounds awesome to a practitioner. But at some level, if you're going through something, that isolation is not healthy. And so as a judge, you've got to be willing to reach out to people and to go to lunch, go to a bar function, just see people and make sure you get somewhere where they'll treat you like a normal human being. Whether that's, you know, your kids' sporting activities, church, you know, again, going to lunch, whatever the case may be, find people. You know, for me, it was people like Todd that I've known for 25 years. You know, find people who will not treat you any differently just because you're, and be a normal person, and it'll help immensely.
Those are great comments. I think with mental health across the board in the profession and among the judiciary, you hit on one of the major points, which is we need to get this stuff out in the open. People are suffering in silence and they've done it for too long. And that's really one of the aims of programming directed to lawyer well-being and now I suppose judicial well-being. I will say that I was impressed and proud of you for, you know, putting that story out there, because I think you've described the result. You were able to help some people who maybe didn't even know that they needed help. So when that light bulb went off for that judge who sent you the note, I mean, that had to make it worthwhile right there, I would think.
Yeah, thank you. And it absolutely did. And, you know, it just, like I said, a lot of notes. I mean, you have one who described just going through a termination trial and how it just kicked her in the gut. She couldn't sleep for days. And, you know, just realizing that people are waking up and going, oh, gosh, this really is affecting me when I leave the office. And like you say, Todd, so much of it's just talking about it. And like I said, the moment I realized there was a problem, I was able to work it out. I mean, I know there are other people who it's actually more of a mental issue and you need to get professional help and things of that nature. And I encourage those judges or lawyers to do that. But a lot of times for a lot of people, it's just realizing there's an issue.
Right.
And figuring out a way to work around it and solve it. Cause I loved my job. I mean, like I said, I would have been a judge for a long time had the electorate had me. It wasn't that. The job was wonderful. I just had to figure out a way. I mean, that was a weird situation with both parents sick and dying. You know, that doesn't happen very often. It just happened to be while I was a judge. And you just have to figure out a way to manage life sometimes. And of course, that's managing what you do for a living as well.
Sure. Well, we want to be respectful of your time. And, you know, we're very grateful for you coming on the show today. We do like to ask guests if they have an anecdote or a war story or possibly a tip or a takeaway. You've certainly given plenty of tips already during the show today, but do you have any parting thoughts for us along those lines?
No, you know, it's funny. Probably the best war story I have is the 80-page 84 of that JNOV. But, you know, it is interesting to me how often – I encourage lawyers to keep doing it anyway. Counsel your clients and give them, you know, the actual answer. But I am amazed how much clients really don't want to hear the answer sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I've really had to adjust so far in, you know, the little over a year I've been back in practice, the urge to tell clients, you know, I'll give you an example. I had a client the other day who wanted me to review a contract that they had done a couple of years back. Tell me how I thought it applied to the situation they were in. And I gave them the answer. And of course that client had drafted that agreement. My answer was completely against how that client intended it. And it was kind of a how dare you response. Like, how dare you say that's what it means? No one could think that's what it means. ask someone else then. And, you know, here's someone, I got someone down the hall to look at it without me telling them what I thought. They thought the same thing. And that client truly did not want to hear that. They wanted to hear what they already had in their mind. And so, look, I mean, it's difficult, but I encourage everyone who listens to the podcast, you got to stick to your guns. And the reason we do appellate law is we become familiar with how courts review these things. We become familiar with how contracts are being interpreted. And there's value to that. And keep being the I've always told people I enjoy the being counselor at law. And mm-hmm. so our job, and I think it's a lot now in the practice, but continue being a counselor at law, even if the client doesn't hear it.
That's good advice. Well, I think we'll wrap up on that note. Thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
And to those of you listening, thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd be grateful if you'd help us get the word out by recommending it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening. Take the time to rate it on Apple Podcasts if you would. That would really help us too.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or just reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.